Too much.
Yeah, I know. It's not going to get better. And the numbers are going to probably may diminish a little bit. So, quick story to get us started. So, I was filming at YU, this guy, Tzvi. So, Tzvi was a really interesting guy. He was a NCSY advisor. He was a Lubavitcher. He was learning at YU. And he was, this doesn't give you a sense so far that he was very Achdus oriented. He would spend Shabbos frequently in Williamsburg with a Satmar lived. And he had a friend whose name, I think, was Baruch. And Baruch was a tremendous Baal HaFnasas Orachim. He and his wife were on a very unusual. So I went with him once for Shabbos to Williamsburg. So I think it was a Satmar guy, Baruch. And we stayed with them for Shabbos, me and my friend Alex. And for whatever reason, that Shabbos, somebody called him Tanya Rebbe, was also staying with them. And it was Shabbos Hanukkah. And I remember it was a big deal the way the Rebbe would light the Neros for Hanukkah. It was a very long. I imagine the bracha may have taken a minute or two. The lighting took a while. And we went to the basement to sleep, so they had all these beds set up. So they constantly, the Shabbos, had many visitors. And then lunch, it was people from the nursing home, it was people from the mental hospital around the block. So it was unreal. It was like really unreal hospitality. And I remember, I think, Baruch saying, Chabad Niggins and Rechad and Mechon Tzvi, and then they sing some Satmar Nugunim. It was very nice. It was very, very Achdus oriented. So what we're going to look at today is we're going to look at what's the Jewish value concerning hospitality dealing with poor people, and why did Yossi Ben Yochanan perhaps see such a need to emphasize it in his generation. So similar to Perkei Avos, as we're frequently doing this year. So take a look at Mishnah Dalet. So that's what we saw last week. That's Yossi Ben Yoezer, who emphasizes the need to bring the Chachamim into one's home. Yossi Ben Yochanan in Mishnah Hay, which part of the Mishnah here, Yossi Ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim is a man of Jerusalem, Omer, their home should be open. Let's translate that in a very wide way. The poor people should be literally the children of your household. They should feel comfortable in your home. How exactly are we going to translate that phrase? So before we really analyze the mission at all, I want to take a look at, anybody familiar with Irving M. Bunim, wrote a book called Ethics from Sinai. I think it was a very popular book, Phil. I think it may still be popular. And I bought a copy years ago, and I took a look at it on this, and I thought this was a really fascinating, a really neat thought. So I want to take a look at this. And this is really, on some level, it's really a historical point. So Irving Ben Bunim writes, notice that both the previous dictum of Yossi Ben Yoezer, as well as the teaching of Yossi Ben Yochanan, addressed themselves to the problem of hospitality. The former, however, emphasized the importance of having sages as your guests, while the latter stresses the value of having your home open wide for the poor. It could be conjectured that the divergence in emphasis stems from the fact that Yossi Ben Yoezer was a man of Tzreda, a small town, while Yossi Ben Yochanan was a resident of Yerushalayim, the large city. In a small town, the more distinguished the guest, the greater the problem. Each household is fearful that his home may not be attractive enough or sumptuous enough for the distinguished guest. If the guest be a religious personality, the host may be self-conscious of his own ignorance or lapses in religious observance. Hence, Yossi Ben Yoezer stresses the need to receive the sage, the distinguished guest, properly and with dignity. In the metropolis, however, the distinguished guest never lacks for a place to stay. Here, the affluent and the social elite vie for the opportunity to display their opulence and good taste to their guest, and to garner the prestige involved in having the renowned visitor as their personal guest. The poor man, however, has a dreadfully difficult time. Few vie for his favor. Furthermore, the indigent one might be unkempt, and his mannerisms not of the finest. Therefore, says Yossi Ben Yochanan, the man of Yerushalayim, let your home be open wide, and in particular, make room for the poor. I think that's a really neat observation. But they're not arguing, but they each need to stress them different based on where they live. That for Yossi Ben Yoezer, I have to stress to you, you should have sages in your home, because I know you're not going to really want to, because you're going to be embarrassed, etc. For Yossi Ben Yochanan, I don't have to tell you that, because if you have the money, you're going to want to have them, and if you don't have the money, you're not going to have a chance to have them, or you'll be too embarrassed. But I have to tell you, you should have the poor over, because there, maybe you're not as enthusiastic about it. And so I have to stress the need to have poor in the home.
So he's talking about having stages. Does he mean traveling stages? Do you need a place to stay, or do you need a place to eat?
That's a good question. Not sure. I can't say either way. Sounds good.
Is really for people who need a place, otherwise they wouldn't just be able to find a place to eat or stay, however, it's on a higher level than just inviting your friends over.
It's certainly kind of the Gemara Pesachim is people used to sleep in the shul. The impression you get that they had meals, and I believe it says slept in the shul as well. I think it's a whole discussion how can you sleep in the shul, right? That's not something you're supposed to be doing in the shul normally. But it seems to me that the shul was a place not just for services, also for travelers. That seems to have a traveling stress. At any rate, it could very well be. It makes sense. Let's take a look now in terms of point number three. How far do we take concern for the poor? So Rav Hirsch frequently, I think the material he has, besides the fact that the main language for us of this is in English, but I think that it's his insights frequently, like he'll summarize enough interesting worthwhile shittos right here. Let's take a look. He has to say Livacha and Exodus 8:11. What does that mean? The Mishnah says your home should be Patuach Livacha. What does that mean? The term Livacha is used to denote relief, literally a widening or loosening of the bonds of want and distress. Similarly, Yossi, let your home be open always to those who suffer and seek relief. And even if you're not able to eliminate all want and distress, be ready at all times to ease and relieve suffering to the best of your ability. Let the poor be members of your household. Regard them as children in your home. Consider your house established not only for yourself and your immediate family, but the homeless poor share in the pleasures of your home, whenever and to whatever extent you can. And when you extend your hospitality to the poor, treat them as you do the members of your own household. And so that we see that what's the idea when the Mishnah says, "You anim b'nei b'secha," it's the stress on how you treat the anim when they come over. There's a couple in I forget where they live, somewhere in Israel. So Rav Machlis and his wife are known for having exceptional hospitality. So I was in share with this fellow who told me that a guy came in on a donkey once, I believe on Shabbos, into the home. Like they'll take anybody. Anybody's welcome to come for a Shabbos meal. So it's the kind of thing where there's almost like a hefkeres, but in a good way, that you allow anybody in. Obviously you're not allowed to feed a donkey at that point if it's not yours, but that's another story. Alright, so if we take a look at I just brought the psukim from Shmuel, just so you can see what Rav Hirsch is quoting there in Pasuk Yud Aleph. See the context here, right? We see it has to do with the Tzfardim, the frogs, or however you want to translate the term. If I'm not mistaken, I think I heard Rav Hirsch translates it actually to mean crocodiles or alligators. But they're dying and creating a stench in the land. But he saw that there was this relief that was coming as a result, and he hardened his heart. Another approach, which I think is nice, Medrash Shmuel, I brought it with me. This is a beautiful sefer. It was written by Rabbi Shmuel ben Yitzchak. I'm going to mess up his name. I think Uzeda, something like that. So he was born in 1540. And he died in the beginning of the 17th century. So he was from Sass. So he was an Israeli. This is a sabra here. So Rabbi Shmuel bar Yitzchak compiled a whole collection of Perkei Avos, and it's from earlier Mefarshim. So this is from earlier Mefarshim being written by somebody who passed away to be in the 17th century. So you get pretty early Mefarshim here. I'll quote the Abarbanel, and he quotes a lot of Mefarshim that you won't have heard of outside of his parish. So he quotes, or actually I think this is his own suggestion here, towards the end of his discussion on this Mishnah, and he says the following. The Asher Ode, it's also possible, Sha'amar, Yehi Beischa Patuach Revacha, what does he mean by let your home be open, let's say broadly, L'chol Ha'olam, Bein La'anim, Bein La'ashirim. I think it's a very nice piece here. It says, whether it be to the poor or to the wealthy, that according to the way the Medrash Shmuel, Rabbi Shmuel ben Yitzchak, is suggesting now, it's not only directed towards having to pour over. Why should that be? It's not that you're only inviting the pour over. Nor only the wealthy. What's the emphasis of Levacha, the way he's reading it? In a broad way. Everybody's welcome. Everybody can come in. It makes no difference if you're poor or you're wealthy. Why should there be this emphasis that everybody's welcome? And with this, when the anim come in to eat in your home, they won't be embarrassed. Why should that be? They'll eat as if they were actual members of the household. Let's say you only have the pour over. You're not interested in having wealthy. Wealthy people don't need to come to me for a meal. They can get a meal on their own. What do I need to invite them for? The problem is, when he does eat by you, he's going to be embarrassed. Why? He knows. Why do you invite him? He's poor. Right? It's not a home, it's a soup kitchen, right? It's a soup kitchen in your living room. So he's going to realize that the only reason you really had him is because of his indigence. Of all. He says, you know what you said before? You're the rich also. You won't be embarrassed anymore. I'll say, you do chesed with everybody. There's a nice story I heard once about Rabbi David Lipschitz. So he was the Mishkeir Chokhani at YU before Rabbi Blau, the current one. If I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Abramson from Anshul Matzla learned under him, Rabbi Shlomo Rosen from the Academy also did, I think. So he was supposed to, I forget what he's called. He had a nickname based on the town in Europe he came from. I forget offhand what the nickname was. But I heard a really nice story about him once where apparently I think there was somebody in the Heights who didn't have a family. I think he was an older fellow who was maybe never married and had no children. And Rav Lipschitz came up to him, and he personally invited him to his daughter's class, I believe. And he made it a point that the man should understand that he would increase Rav Lipschitz's simcha by being at the class. Now, something on those lines, building people up. So it's clearly the idea here that there's this concern for how's the ani going to feel if he just feels like it's a handout, right? There's a concept of bread of humiliation, right? The Ram Kol discusses this idea that when Hashem, why did Hashem make the world? So the Ram Kol's Yisod, his approach is that it was to give tova. It was in order to benefit others. So what do I need the world for? Right? Just sticking a olam hala and I'm good, right? So the way the Ram Kol explains is people get embarrassed if you get a handout. It's the nature of a being to be embarrassed by, at least let's say an intelligent being. The nature of intelligent beings embarrassed by gifts, by handouts. So we had to earn our keep. That way when we go up to olam hala, we won't be embarrassed by all the chef or the bounty. Right, the whole idea, the way Narfal explains it in this world is so we won't be embarrassed at all. It's interesting. It's a beautiful take. So there's an idea that the proper way to do chesed is you have to be very sensitive to the feelings of the recipient. Lo ba'avor anav karaso. So it's not because of his being poor that you called him. If they really feel like you're members of the household, they won't be embarrassed at all. According to this, when you look at the Mishnah, the way you're supposed to read it, right, is that it should be open to everybody. There should be no embarrassment. The anim should feel absolutely 100% at home. Just one other makor I think is very nice that's in this vein also. In Imre Baruch, Rabbi Baruch Simon, actually took quotes from Rabbi Mordechai Bennett. And the following idea, I think it's a really beautiful idea. There's a Gemara, it sounds very strange. The Gemara says that it's the same idea, but I think it's a beautiful formulation. The Gemara says that if I give money to a poor person, and I say that I'm giving it in order so that my son should live, this is a tzedakah gomor. Right. So I'm giving it to tzedakah, because right, the way the Gemara sounds is that the noticing the person giving is his son is ill, his son or daughter is ill, is giving the tzedakah so that the child should live. This is tzedakah gomor. So what's the obvious question?
Sounds like an ulterior motive.
Very ulterior, right? Doesn't sound like it's the big
one. It's a fixed
mitzvah. Right. So I heard recently from a friend of mine who was in the neighborhood, Rabbi Shapiro, told me I believe this is where I heard it from, that there's apparently there's a different kirsa, maybe that says Sadaka Gemura. I mean, it's 100% Sadaka. Right, it doesn't detract from the mitzvah of Sadaka. But Rabbi Mordechai Benin has a different approach. He reads it like this. It doesn't say somebody who gives in order so that the child should live is a Sadaka Gemura. It's just somebody who says that this is so the child should live is a Sadaka Gemura. So Rabbi Benin explains like this. It's not, he doesn't have a sick kid. But he doesn't want the ani to feel bad. So what does he say? I'm giving him the money because my kid is ill and I want him to be better. So the ani thinks, oh, I'm doing him a favor. Right? So he feels good when he takes the money because it's a reciprocal. Is that a nice idea? Oh, interesting. So I guess the way he reads it, that doesn't seem to be concerned. Maybe the chesed involved. I'm not sure. Or maybe, I'm not sure. I mean, if you take it as an ayin hara approach, so not everybody is concerned by Ayin Hara, as I understand it. So maybe that's how he understands. At any rate, I think it's a beautiful approach that what's the Tzadik Gemura? The concern, it's not just for physical welfare. I'm concerned for his emotional state, that he or she shouldn't feel bad about themselves because of receiving the money. There's many other approaches that the Medrash Shmuel brings down. One is that Levacha may actually refer to not having your home open like in a back road. In other words, let's say my house opens up, the back door goes into an alleyway. So the door open for the Inyan shouldn't be in the alley. It should be in a place where everybody's going to see it. Everybody's going to be able to come in. So there's stress on it should be accessible to everybody. One very interesting approach, which he cites, I don't remember offhand if this is his own or if he's citing from somebody else, is that you're actually not supposed to read it as an if-then, that you're supposed to understand the first clause to be the result and the second clause to be the condition. In other words, he reads it, your home will be pasuch levacha, it will be prepared to receive shefa, it will be prepared to receive HaKadosh Baruch Hu's brachas, assuming anim b'nei v'sacha, assuming that you make the poor members of your household. That's also a nice suggestion. Another approach he cites, which is very fascinating, is the idea of the galgal, that everything in life revolves. Right now I'm on the top, and eventually I'll be in the doghouse, and it keeps going around. So he says that you should make the... He says you should have your home be 100% open for the poor, because you should know that one day, I think this is how he reads it, the poor people are going to be your household members. If you have to be appreciative where you are now and where you're going to be, and you want somebody to be kind to you, you have to be kind to others. And there's all these different permutations as to how to read the words. Obviously, the lesson that's going to come out of every one of these permutations is sensitivity to the needs of the poor, right? Whether that be physical and or emotional. Come to section number 4 here. What might our Mishnah have to say about slavery? That's very interesting, the point you made about Palestine. I guess I'll just say very quickly. I heard a story once, if I'm correct, the story, I think it was about Rav Chaim Volozhin, where somebody was having these nightmares, and he said, it's just a dream, don't worry about it. And I believe something then bad happened, and the nightmares occurred, and he said, it's a dream, don't worry about it. And this, it was like an ongoing thing, where I think his attitude was, we don't worry about these things, and you have to just be straight and not get caught up in this stuff. And I know when I spoke to a big London at one point, and if I recall correctly, when he told me, when we were discussing this, was that if you can just ignore like a bad dream and move on, that's the better way to go. So just not to get caught up in like anything that feels like an omen or a
association between Yaakov and
the Russia,
still,
I don't know,
he died.
Don't some understand that to actually been a koala, though? I mean, not in the sense that he meant to, but that the...
Yeah, he was a koala. He was saying, you know, but he was saying it's on the basis of it's impossible, you're not going to find anybody.
Right.
This is what they won't find anybody.
Right. He certainly didn't want that to happen. Right.
So they make them all easier.
Interesting point. Not sure. So God willing, we'll discuss that.
Be careful what you wish to
record. Yeah.
We already discussed a little bit in context of Tzedek and Baisos. Let's take a look now. The Rambam and Rashi have strikingly similar comments on this Mishnah as it refers to slavery. So what does the Rambam say? You, Anim B'nei V'Secha, the poor should be members of your house. What does that mean? Yomar Sheru Eishiyu Misham Shecha Hadalim V'Anim. Who should be your butler? Who should be your maid for some reason seems to carry negative connotations to me, but you know, the butler, the major domo of the household, who should these people be? They should be the poor people. You could either have a slave, or you could give sustenance to some poor person who needs a job anyway. So I could either procure a slave and go to the slave market and buy a slave, or I just hire somebody who needs the income anyway. The sages denigrated the acquisition of slaves, and they praised making use of poor people. And that's who your servant should be. And from those who take refuge in his shade. Meaning, if you have the opportunity to either purchase a slave or give an income to a poor person, so why on earth would you purchase a slave? There's some poor guy who needs the job anyway, so give him a job. Give her a job. Rashi also understands this to be that we don't believe in the value of increasing slaves and shafachos, maid servants, right? Rather, we would have poor people doing the job. Now, number five, why might our Tana have needed to emphasize the evils of slavery? So the two sources I want to bring on here on this point, Rav Gershom Harfness, in his Sefer Eden HaTalmud, which I've referred to in the past.
What century is he?
So he's contemporary. I don't know if he's still alive. I assume he is. He wrote, well, he's a Holocaust survivor. He's a Hungarian, if I recall correctly. So he wrote the Sefer, which is, the idea is to give an account of the history of the sages from basically the time period of Ezra up till the Crusades, if I recall correctly. So he says here, Yossi ben Yochanan, Shahaya Ab Beistin Bedoro. Yossi ben Yochanan was the Ab Beistin in his generation. Karla'am, he summoned the nation of his Chazik, the Sharshe Torah Sachesed, to strengthen themselves in the roots of the Torah of Chesed, Shoyadus. Meaning, Judaism obviously believes in kindness, and so he had to be emphasize strongly this value. Why? The Nigud Lahashkafos Hayavanim. It was an opposition to the values of literally the Greeks. We know that the people in charge of Israel weren't literally Greek, but they were culturally Greek. They were at one point Egyptian, another point Syrian, but they were, thank you, but they were culturally Hellenized. Sharaba Abdus Yisod Ratsui Uvari Bechevra. They perceived in slavery a desirable and healthy foundation in society. Darash Yossi ben Yochanan, Pionim ben Ebisecha. So he came against this. Yom Kom Lavasis, Avodos Abais, Fahameshek, Alavadim, Mutav, Shetishkor, Poalim, Mibnei Anye Israel. Better to hire a poor Jew than to purchase a slave. You'll help him out. You're going to give him parnas. You're going to give him income. Right, that your brother should live with you. That there's a Jewish value in helping out somebody, an indigent person. It's not a Jewish value necessarily to amass a large amount of avodim. Right, even were somebody to live in a part of the world today where avdus is legal. Right, it would not be a strong push on getting yourself a whole cadre of avodim, but rather it would be much better to help out poor people who need a parnasa. The Greek influence that was happening at this time, we discussed that this was during the time of the Hashmayim Kanaka. I will point out this week I saw Frank Orbach in his book The Sages. Apparently understands he lived in the generation before that, but at least with Harkness and who else did I see this in? Rabbi Benjamin Lau both understand that they were at the same time. Here's a Chashmonaim, and that's how I'm going to assume. I'm going to take it that way. So they both understand that this is the time of the Chashmonaim. This major Hellenistic value is coming in. Who was Alexander's teacher? Aristotle. Now Aristotle, as we're going to see as our last source, felt that slavery was a very natural, healthy part of human existence, right? And so as a consequence, Yossi ben Yochanan has to take what was a Jewish value, he didn't even make it up, but he had to emphasize in his generation to oppose the inroads that the Hellenism was making, the values that Alexander had taught, had been taught presumably by Aristotle, and had then conveyed in turn to his generals and then the culture that came from that.
That doesn't mean that...
Not just... I just want to take a look. not that Alexander was a bad person, right? We have a nuanced view of him. Right? Chazal certainly don't view him as having been some wicked, but that doesn't mean that every value he brought in is, necessarily. I'm assuming that even if he wasn't the one who brought it in, right, it was a result of the Hellenistic inroads that took place. Sorry.
That doesn't mean that during the time of Rambam and Rashi, the Jews were still buying slaves. It's because he's just commenting on
they're explaining the Mishnah. I can't say for a fact that there weren't Jewish slaves at that time. I mean, I imagine it would depend what part of the world you lived in. In other words, if you lived, I don't know. I mean,
the world has slaves today.
Right. Unless I'm mistaken, there are enough countries that slavery is still probably legal. So the way it's usually conducted is probably, I imagine, grotesquely inhumane. But that's not our focus right now. Certainly in America it was awful. Rashi was in France. Were there slaves in France? I don't think so, but I don't know that for a fact. The Rambam lived in Egypt. Was there slavery in Egypt? It might have been. I'm not sure.
During the time of the mission, it was a practical issue.
Oh yeah, and the truth is, even in France where Rashi lived, even if there you weren't maybe officially slave, I don't know what existed there, but with the whole feudal system. I'm sure he saw plenty of non-Jews who functionally were about him, if within the feudal system, if not in the sense you could buy them and sell them. But whether or not that, I don't think that's prompting his understanding of the mission. I think the fact that one's in France and one's in Egypt from Spain, I think this is how they understood Pshat in the mission. I don't think this has anything to do with their own societal circumstances. Now, Rav Gorin, who was the at one place, she probably the IDF. There's a famous, for anybody who's seen the footage, right? He blew the shelf at the Kotel when it was liberated. So he wrote, I bought the Sefer in the summer. I saw it in Manny's Nechemiah Sharim, and it looked interesting. So I got into Jewish philosophy last year and a half, so I picked it up. Torah of Philosophy, all right? It's kind of obvious from the title what the book is about. So he said the following. And he's the one who gave me the Mar Malkom, the last one we're going to look at here. So, Shoni Ekroni Nosaf Hashuv Biotir. So, an additional important moral difference between Hashkafot Aristo and Hashkafot HaYahadut, between the philosophy of Aristotle, Aristo's Aristotle, and that of Judaism. That has to do with the evolution, the development of the political idea. So Aristotle believed in the naturalness of slavery in the world. As he writes in Politica, and if I recall correctly, he writes it elsewhere also. I did some online research, but I didn't want to bring down too much, as it is. It took up almost the whole page, the third page. Sefer Aleph Perek Vav. Because you have free people and you have slavery, all piyateva. This is a perfectly natural phenomenon. Which I understood to mean it's not only beneficial, it's correct. That they should be slaves. It's a proper thing. It's a normal thing. It's natural. So in contrast to this, we find the Jewish political idea founded on the freedom of humanity. Right? There's this concept in Judaism, and so again, this is Chumash, right? That man and woman are made in the image of God. Regarding the full equality and merit to people in all areas of life and possession. Right, the Torah was concerned for the statutes of the Torah concerned for the agrarian division, Shavah, an equal agrarian division. When the nation had divided up the land, right, different tribes, Shvatim, were supposed to get different portions of the land. There was this concern that every tribe, every Sheva should be getting a certain portion. In addition to this, Manu, and I found this very interesting when I read this over the summer. It's the only chapter in the book I've read so far, time limitations, but this really changed the way I looked at a particular mitzvah. But also, Manu Kol Efsharot Shel Arichut Shnuyim B'Shuvion HaChaluka HaGravit B'Tzikut Zman Ayeruchuz Admot L'Mala Min Ham. Okay? The Adayim vote to do it. What's the idea here? Well, let's keep going. L'chein ba'a mitzvah ha'yovel. K'dei la'atiyach es ha'chazeres ha'shidyon ha'gravi l'karmuso midei kol ha'mishim shana ka'amor. And we close the pasuk. What's going on? Every few years we have yovel. What's the point? So, I never thought about it this way, even though it might be 100% pashut. It might be totally clear to everybody else. Every few years the land reverts line so that you don't have Bill Gates stockpiling everything and not denigrating him either, right? He Kosh Broker gave him a lot of money, and Kosh Broker gave him enough sense that he gives a lot of it to Tzedakah, so I'm not going to be the one to slander him. So, but the Torah doesn't apparently want somebody to have all the land, right? So the 50 years, barring certain circumstances, there's a reversal. The land reverts. Right. It's interesting. I never thought about it this way, but it's very straightforward when you see it. So she says, Bishana Hayogel Makabo Ha'am Mechadesh Et Ikaron Acherus HaShimyon. Right. So there's this, again, there's this, it sort of levels the playing field. He goes on, it's not only when it comes to agrarian, there's also a concern financial, monetarily. Because with Hashmat HaSakhsafim, right, that if I lent money, so there's a point at which I can't collect anymore. Right, that the Shemitah undoes loans, right, which is why Bezman Hazeh, that it's a Dilabanan, we have the concept of Cruzbal, right, so that people will still lend money to poor people, because we understand that if we, at least when it's a Dilabanan, and we can do this, that if we don't allow people to still collect through the court, right, people won't lend the money because they'll be concerned that they're not going to ever get it back. So what do we see here? We see contrasting worldviews, right? The worldview as Rabbi Gorin presents it of the Greeks, and we see Rabbi Hoffman's book is referenced, and I put right here a piece from Aristotle. I did a lot of ellipses because it would have just been way too lengthy as it was, but you at least get a sense. What does he say? He says here, let's look at the second part here in chapter 4. The master is only the master of the slave. He does not belong to him, whereas the slave is not only the slave of his master, but wholly belongs to him. Hence we see what is the nature and office of a slave. Who is by nature not his own, but another's man, is by nature a slave. And he would be said to be another's man, who, being a human being, is also a possession. And a possession would be defined as an instrument of action, separable from the possessor. Chapter 5 is where he says it more explicitly. But is there anyone thus intended by nature to be a slave, and for whom such a condition is expedient and right, or rather is not all slavery a violation of nature? There is no difficulty in answering this question, on grounds both of reason and of fact, for that some should rule and others be ruled, is a thing not only necessary but expedient, from the hour of their birth. Some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. I'll point out right now that I left out the gender comment he makes off his line, but you can imagine what it is. And there are many kinds, both of rulers and subjects. Let's skip the parentheses. Where then there is such a difference as that between soul and body, or between men and animals? Skip the parentheses again. The lower sort are by nature slaves, and it is better for them as for all inferiors that they should be under the rule of a master. For he who can be and therefore is in others, and he who participates in rational principle enough to apprehend, but not to have such a principle, is a slave by nature. It is clear then that some men are by nature free and others slaves, and that for these latter slavery is both expedient and right. He goes on, right, that's chapter 6 I put down there. Again, there's ellipses, I've skipped over because of too much material. But you see, for Aristotle, it's a perfectly natural part of life. There are meant to be slaves. That's the way it's supposed to be. Now, obviously halacha allows for optus. There's a concept within the Torah of optus. It's not that, what's that?
It is a punishment.
Well, certainly in the concept of Eved Ivri, there's an idea of a
king backwards from home.
Yeah, and a king, right. And it's not only that, but there's also an idea. Let's say I'm a thief. I'm constantly stealing from people. So the base thing can sell me, so anything can sell me to. There's something in a family that presumably is going to have better values, and hopefully I'll learn from that, and I won't go back on the streets and do more of the same. And I think that's the idea here. The idea is you don't put them in jail so that they lift weights and learn how to pick locks more efficiently than they did before. The idea is that you try to make them a better person. Now, there is also an idea of obvious as a result of war. You know, all these ideas need to be fleshed out, but I do think that it's fair to say that given the way Rav Gorin explains, and Rav Harfness also, and I think it's a nice explanation, I see Rav Gorin focuses more on slavery as something which is very much not a Jewish thing, regardless. The way I read it in Rav Gorin, it doesn't have much to do with whether... anyway, Rav Gorin seems to assume that slavery is not the ideal And obviously Aristotle very much thinks it is the ideal. So with that, we can very much understand why Yossi ben Yochanan and his generation felt such a strong need to emphasize that the Aniyim should be b'nei Sacha, that you can't simply be going out and getting 30 slaves, right? You have to try to employ people who are in the indigent, etc. In terms of what the Torah's view on this is in general, that would require more fleshing out, and that's not going to help us necessarily with the Mishnah. So
the concept of it's not
right. And the truth is, you have to understand
that they can inherit it from generation to generation.
But we also have to appreciate that even within the concept of the Kanani in Halacha, there are limitations that in the way the American form never would have been viable. Like if the master would strike and not get a tooth, bye-bye of it, right? So this could be a totally non-Jewish slave you picked up and now you've lost him because you mistreated him. Whereas if you think about how it worked in American law, right, the guy was so sorely beaten, probably ran away, and then he just got returned back to the owners who were beating him all along. So it's a very different perspective. Not to mention the fact that they become quasi-Jews in the process, which is another issue. Yeah.